This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. North Carolina has produced countless sports stars over the years. Basketball's Meadowlark Lemon, pitcher Gaylord Perry, boxer Sugar Ray Leonard, NASCAR's Earnhardts, just to name a few. But none has the world recognition of Michael Jordan.
With 20 seconds left to play, goes back to Michael Jordan. Jumper from out on the left. Good! The Tar Heels are going to win the national championship.
The inbounds pass comes into Jordan. Here's Michael at the foul line. A shot on Elo. Good! The Bulls win it! They win it! Michael Jordan hits it at the foul line.
To Livingston. Jordan. Oh! A spectacular move by Michael Jordan. That's 13 consecutive field goals.
The tongue is out. Something bad about to happen to the Lakers. It's Michael Jordan taking off for the deuce.
He has dazzled sportscasters and sports fans, first in Chapel Hill, then around the world, as the NBA's greatest player. But through all the championships, MVP awards, and All-Star games, Michael Jordan kept many personal issues to himself. He faced overt racism in the 1970s in North Carolina. There were allegations of sexual assault in his immediate family. And it was clear in the 1990s that Michael Jordan liked to gamble. Sports writer Roland Lazenby has written a new biography of Michael Jordan that explores the roots of his competitive nature and much, much more. The book is called Michael Jordan, The Life. And Roland Lazenby joins me now on The State of Things. Welcome, Roland.
Thank you, Frank.
You wrote a book about the man who really everybody knows around the world as the greatest basketball player of all time. It must be a challenge to write a book about a guy who we think we know so much about, was it?
Oh, yes. It almost ruined my health. It was day after day after day of labor for almost 4 years. It was quite a physical challenge as well as a mental challenge.
Well, you took an interesting approach. You started this project by looking at census records and other documents in the Jordan family. Why did you take that approach?
If you're going to go in, you really have to have a different look. And to really start with the facts, you have to build from the ground up in his family, in the cultural story, at least open the door to all the many influences. And I really wanted a comprehensive look at who the Jordans were. Another thing was sort of my personal history. I grew up in the South. The schools integrated when I was 13. So my first experience was with Jim Crow, but then I soon made friends. I saw how their parents were treated. And, you know, that affected me my whole life. And as I covered Jordan and the Bulls in the 90s and wrote about them, and I saw what an extraordinary person he was, I just always was engaged with the idea, you know, he's the product of generations. Who were these fierce people before Michael Jordan? And I wanted to know who those people were.
Well, take us back. Who were his great-grandfathers? Interesting stuff that you found about them.
Yes. Dawson Jordan was born in 1891. In Holly Shelter on the coastal plain of North Carolina. He was only 5'5" and crippled, but he was a fierce man who lorded over the Jordan family until Michael was 14 when he died. And he was a very strong person who generated a lot of community acclaim in his own right. He was a moonshiner. He was a sharecropper. He was a really tough customer. And then on his mother's father, Michael's grandfather, Edward Peoples, also from the same community. But, you know, I looked, Michael had the 6 NBA championships he had of his accomplishments. But I found a 1922 report from the North Carolina Board of Agriculture on sharecropping. I found it in the UNC library. I'm not sure it had ever seen the light of day, but it had talked to thousands of landless farmers, black and white, in North Carolina. And the story it told was of a wrecked, failed system. Everybody lost. No one could gain anything, black or white. And yet Michael Jordan's grandfather won the game of sharecropping. He came to own his own land. He worked and worked and worked. He farmed all the time. He had a job in the very brutal lumber yards. And yes, he too was a moonshiner. But he wasn't a very friendly guy. And he really influenced Michael's mother, Dolores. This man was very focused on economic success. And so I looked at those ancestors and I said, well, these are remarkable stories in their own right.
Yeah, I mean, that is an incredible story. Sharecropping, you said it didn't work for anybody. It did work for the landowners, we should point out.
Of course.
It was
yes.
a fine system yes. for them. But as you say, anybody in that system who was sharecropping, the idea that you could actually ever beat the system and own your own land was pretty preposterous, particularly if you're black. So this is an amazing find that you came up with. And then we'll talk about Michael as well, because that's also part of the story. We're talking about all these kind of fierce ancestors that he's gotten. And so if you look at a guy who is the success that Michael Jordan is, you think, well, that's where it came from. But Michael wasn't always a success. Tell us about his first venture into sports as a child. Started in Little League Baseball, had early success, and then kind of hit the ceiling, right?
Yes, it did. And I think that had a lot to do with it. First, there was failure in that he failed to secure his father's approval. And as I point out, that pretty much hardwired Michael Jordan. He spent his life proving his worth. Michael realized soon that his father loved baseball. It was obvious. He would pitch to the boys in the backyard. The Jordans were probably the first helicopter parents. They were at every practice. And Michael came out of the gate in Little League Baseball. He was the North Carolina Player of the Year. He threw two no-hitters. He hit a 270-foot home run in the playoffs for the Little League World Series and almost took his team to the Little League World Series. The next year, he went to Babe Ruth League and hardly got off the bench. And so this failure and this thing his father loved was really tough. And that, of course, is the setup that's been overlooked. Michael was quickly became and showed this tremendous ability as a basketball player. He was obviously the best ninth grade player, but he did not make the varsity and played on the junior varsity. And that was a huge disappointment to Michael Jordan. These things really sort of set up this mental approach he took to competing that was sort of scorched earth.
You talk about the lifelong effort to gain the attention and affection of his father. And around this time, there was a pretty serious incident in his family. You write about Michael Jordan having to grapple with allegations about sexual abuse in his family. What happened?
Well, you know, Michael, it's not clear, obviously, because this is not something the family discusses. It is an extremely painful thing, obviously, for any family. But Michael's sister in 1975 made allegations that her father had been sexually abusing her over a period of time. It was explosive, obviously, within the marriage. That was not something that Michael had knowledge of as a 12-year-old. Just when he gained knowledge of that is unclear. There were talks that the Jordans were going to require the daughter to leave the family. The incident, however, was not investigated by authorities, neither social services nor police. And so it sort of was this horrific seed of division in the family over decades. A lot of that division unarticulated. It's not something that people talked about. But everyone noticed that the Jordans were delightful people in many ways. Yet there was, to many observers, it was obvious the mother and father were not close. And they came to, as Michael Jordan became a professional player and began making large amounts of money, the mother and father came into tremendous conflict.
We talked about the fact that some of what we know about Michael Jordan and some of what we didn't know. I mean, I think anybody who's a Tar Heel fan or has followed Michael Jordan's career knows how he came to Chapel Hill and he immediately challenged some of the team's best players. I mean, he comes on the team with people like James Worthy are on the team, right? And he challenges them, but UNC was not his first choice.
No, it was not on network TV. He had seen UCLA. He was also very aware of Ralph Sampson at the University of Virginia, and he really wanted to go to UVA. Most of the people in Wilmington tended to think that Michael could not get on the court at North Carolina, that the other players were simply too good and he would sit the bench. And Michael believed this pretty much himself. And so he wrote the coaches at the University of Virginia a letter asking to be recruited. And I interviewed Terry Holland, who was the coach at Virginia at the time, another fine son of North Carolina. And Terry Holland admitted that they were busy recruiting other players. And, of course, the other half of that story is that Michael did go to the University of North Carolina. He did come in with a very fierce competitive nature, so much so that James Worthy, his friend and former teammate, described him as a bully. And they very quickly began competing with the University of Virginia, which had a top program and the top player in 7'4", Ralph Sampson. And Michael Jordan played a large role in subverting Virginia's championship ambitions. A lot of Wahoo fans aren't aware that they could have had Michael Jordan on their team, but it was a very painful time for them anyway.
Well, and Michael Jordan seemed to want to take it out on them every time he had the chance, didn't he?
And he did. You know, I've seen him play hundreds of times, and still the single most impressive play I've seen in all my years of covering basketball was at U-Hall, University Hall in Charlottesville in 1983. Michael was a sophomore. UVA had a long winning streak there, and Carolina had come into Charlottesville and run up a big lead, and then in the second half, UVA stormed back, and they had cut the lead to 6 points with a little under 2 minutes to go. Sampson came down and took an elbow jumper from the left elbow. Jordan was all the way down on the right block. He leapt across the lane and slammed Ralph Sampson's jump shot. It was such a ferocious block. Everybody on press row jumped. They were startled. 15 years later, I was sitting in Charlotte one night with Michael before a pregame. He was having a cup of coffee getting ready to play the old Hornets. And I asked him about that block. And Michael said, you know, that was the amazing thing about everything that happened in my career. I had no idea I could do the things I did. And they surprised even me. And that block shocked me as much as it shocked anyone.
A shocking, I think, is probably the word that comes to mind when we see and think about all of what he did on the field, an unbelievable, defying physics. What about as a player? You know, James Worthy noted, calls him a bully in a way, in a sort of an affectionate way. What was he like in his professional career? He has this image, too, of a guy who's kind of a even-keeled guy, but was he in the locker room? What was he like?
Well, you know, it's the story of America in a lot of ways, the individual versus the group. He went to the Bulls. It was a terrible franchise. The roster was riddled with cocaine abusers. The team was on the verge of economic failure. It was sold at bargain basement prices right in the middle of his rookie year. Michael then went through a series of coaches. He did not trust the Bulls. He really was very disappointed at everything that happened. They were getting pounded by the Pistons in the playoffs. And then suddenly here comes Phil Jackson with this assistant, Tex Winter, who had a very tight system of his own, the triangle offense. And Tex Winter, as he explained to me, if Michael had not played in that system offense at North Carolina, you probably couldn't have gotten him in the midst of all the cynicism to begin to bridle his game and to fit into a team concept. But once he did that, and it was a nightly issue, how much was Michael going to right. try to be this alpha male, or how much was he going? And he became a master at reading and fitting in that system. And that's how the Chicago Bulls won 6 championships, using this beautiful discipline along with Michael's unbelievable everything, his will, his athleticism, and then the emergence of Scottie Pippen, just an amazing player who could do everything, that took so much pressure off of Michael Jordan, this man who heaped all this pressure on himself?
Well, if there's an asterisk at all in his career, it certainly is when he made headlines for gambling in the 1990s, a report that he lost more than $1 million playing a round of golf with a friend, or $500,000, whatever it was. Jordan disputes that, but at the time, he said, look, let's listen to this clip, because he said, hey, I like to bet, and I'm a great basketball player, so live with it and listen.
Soon, whenever I walk away from this game, I think that's the only thing that people are going to say was a bad thing about Michael Jordan. No, I didn't commit a crime, but he gambled. And if that's the least that I could be considered or have on my repertoire, on my, you know, resume, that, hey, I'm a competitor and I gambled, let's say $500,000, and yet I'm still living, I'm not broke. Financially, I still think I'm set. I don't have to work. And I choose to do whatever I choose to do once I leave the game of basketball, then I'm happy.
All right. Well, that was more than 20 years ago. Was he right? Is that how we feel about him? And is he still happy?
You know, Michael had become sort of this Jesus figure. In fact, Tim Hallam, the longtime PR guy for the Bulls, began referring to him as Jesus. You know, he would ask his PR assistants, he would say, have you seen Jesus today, in reference to Jordan. And I remember writing a magazine story that reveals some of his hard edge. And I was writing for Sport Magazine, and my editor questioned, he said, are you sure you want to write this about Michael Jordan? It's like you're writing about God,
yeah.
You know, that might get a fatwa against you or something. Right. It was tough, but he had that image. And then boom, right on the heels of that, suddenly here come all these revelations about his gambling on golf, gambling at casinos. And the story just kept getting worse. But for him, you know, the NBA has long been a gambling league. They gambled on trains before they gambled on planes. And in fact, the Bulls scheduled their 1997 fall of 96 preseason games in Las Vegas, where they all went. Mm. And they brought Dennis Rodman to the roster. He was this huge gambler. He was shooting $50,000 craps hands at Las Vegas while Michael was playing baseball. So, and then David Stern worked so hard to make Michael the owner in Charlotte. If Michael had ever dishonored the game,
yeah,
none of that would have ever happened.
Hey, let's talk about that now that he is in Charlotte. Once again, the Hornets, a franchise that made the playoffs this year, but it's been struggling for years. Well, how does Michael Jordan rate as a team owner?
Charlotte was the Chernobyl of the NBA. It had been an absolutely fabulous basketball market. Fans were packed to the rafters. Every time I covered a game in Charlotte, I was just geeked. It was a tremendous atmosphere. And then George Shinn managed to undo it all. And at the end, it was a very sad state of affairs. You know, he finally moved the team out of town. Charlotte basketball fans who love the game had lost all trust with pro basketball. And Michael has made his mistakes. You can get on the internet and you'll see constant people, and certainly Bobcats, now Hornets fans again, who hear this. Some of them will be complaining, Michael did this, Michael did that. Yes, he made his mistakes, but he has reestablished trust with that Charlotte fan base. And he listened. He would go into that spare gym after that young Bobcats team would have those horrible losses, and the world was calling him the worst owner, and he would face the season ticket holders. And he listened, and he made changes. And if you notice, they made the playoffs this year, but that wasn't the important thing. They got swept. But that building was packed to the rafters, and all that old energy that the Hornets had in their glory days, that had returned. You know, everything Michael's ever done besides play has been overlooked. He was so thrilling as a player. He set such expectations. People are disappointed and they get angry because he's not the most competent human being on the planet as he was in basketball. But he's determined to have this second act, this afterlife, and he is finding success. Now they will be the Hornets this fall. It's not hard to project that Michael Jordan is going to find success and is finding success as an owner in Charlotte.
Hey, Roland, great to talk with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Sports writer Roland Lazenby's new biography is called Michael Jordan, The Life. Thanks so much for talking with us, and thanks for listening. By the way, more ahead, we're going to travel the Blue Ridge Music Trails. Stay with us on The State of Things.